On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have Mr. Curtis Franklin here today, and Comcast is back in the news, and they're bringing back their data caps, but Massachusetts ain't having it. We'll talk about it. Plus, the pandemic is still going on, and it's more important even now to talk about data privacy. Curtis will get into that. Plus, we have two great guests today. We have Trend Micro on, and they're going to talk about endpoint security and just what you should do to ensure your organization is ready for the new norm. Shouldn't miss it. Twi on the set. Our annual survey is going strong, and we don't want to miss your feedback. Go to twit.tv/survey21 to take it now before it closes on February 8th. The survey helps us understand our audience so we can make your listening experience even better. It'll only take a few minutes. Go to twit.tv/survey21 to take it.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 428, recorded January 29th, 2021. What's up with endpoint security? This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Forward Networks. Forward Networks reduces business risk by revolutionizing the way large networks are managed. Their advanced software delivers a digital twin of the network, a completely accurate mathematical model in software. Get a demo at forwardnetworks.com/twit. And by Nareva. Getting your audio ready for meetings back in the office? Nareva Audio is designed for distancing. It automatically adapts to new room configurations so you're ready for the new normal and whatever comes next. Learn more at nareva.com/twit. Welcome to Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide to this big, giant world, the enterprise. I can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in a professional, an expert in their field. I think we're going to be the dynamic duo today. That's right. Mr. Curtis Franklin is here today. He's a senior analyst at Omdia, and he lives and breathes security. Welcome to the show, Curtis. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing very well. It's great to be here on a beautiful Friday afternoon, and it's been a great week. I've gotten to enjoy doing what I most enjoy about being an analyst, and that is talk to companies about the products and technologies that they're going to be bringing to market. This week, I talked to one of the most established companies in the security space, somebody with a startup that is just getting their first couple of customers, and the developer of an open source project that is solving a problem that others have solved on the commercial end, but he's doing it free and open source. So a great combination, and this is a great way to wrap up the week.
Indeed it is. You know what? The week has been interesting for security. A lot of wins for the good guys. Have you seen that? Where we're going to get into it a little bit later with some of the stories that we go through, but are you seeing a lot more, services and systems and even security companies actually having some wins this past week?
Well, I think that what we have, this is one of those serendipitous weeks where if you look at some of the things we're going to be talking about, these are some ongoing projects, some ongoing campaigns that happen to reach fruition at around the same time. But I think it's great for security when that can happen, because we need those shots in the arm once in a while to let us know that the good guys can still win.
Indeed. Well, like Curtis said, it has been quite the week in the enterprise and the IT news. And of course, security never sleeps. So we're going to get to some stories there. In fact, we're going to start with Comcast is trying to get back and bring back their data caps. But, some states are actually trying to fight back, and we'll take you through what's happening there. Plus, obviously, the pandemic is still going on. It's even more important to talk about privacy and security. So Curtis and I will get into that. We'll have a chat about that. But, we also have two really great guests today. We have Trend Micro on, and they're going to talk about endpoint security and just what people are doing to ensure that they're ready for the new norm. But before we get into all that goodness, let's go ahead and jump into this week's news blips. Now, sandboxes for applications are not new. It's a way to isolate the execution of an application that might need to load assets that could be actually vulnerable to an attack vector which actually could affect the rest of the operating system, even the Launch Explorer. Well, Apple continues to adopt this execution model for applications in order to add a new layer of a security to their applications. Now, it may be an older model for developing applications, but Apple had to give it a catchy code name to revive it into something new. Now, they call it Blastdoor. Now, I bet you're envisioning Star Wars right now, aren't you? Well, I'm definitely envisioning Planet Hoth there. Well, according to the member of the Google's Project Zero team, Apple's iOS 14 operating system includes a new security sandbox system designed to protect iMessage users from potential malicious code. Now, Blastdoor was quietly shipped with iOS 14 last year through Apple. Has not made it publicly referencing it yet as a security feature, but written in relatively safe Swift programming language, Blastdoor is responsible for actually parsing nearly all untrusted data in iMessages. Now, before iOS 14, steps like decompressing binary data or decoding the plist from binary serialization format or even field extraction and decoding the X key were actually performed by the IM agent. Now, IM agent is at the head of processing flow, but critical operations like that are actually now forwarded to Blastdoor. Now, the sandbox actually prohibits communication with most inter-process communication services or IPC services, and it blocks nearly all file system interactions, and it forbids any interaction with the IOKit drivers, and it denies outbound network traffic, which is really good. Now, the system essentially unpacks content, both text and attachments, in a safe sandboxed environment, and it prevents malicious code from actually interacting with iOS or accessing local data. Now, what does this mean for you and your organization? Well, it means that your device will be more secure now that remote code execution is almost impossible through the messaging system. So that's great. Now, I don't know about you, but it's about time that messaging systems have caught up with the infamous ICQ messaging features. All they need now is the cool sound effects.
Well, ransomware payoffs surged by 311% to nearly $350 million. Ransomware payments using cryptocurrency surged at 311% in 2020, nearing a total volume of $350 million as cyber criminals gravitated to crypto locking as the easiest way to turn compromised systems into cash. This is according to blockchain analysis company Chainalysis, and it said this in an analysis published this week. While ransomware payments through cryptocurrencies are skyrocketing, cybercrime overall is accounting for less volume of digital currency transactions, according to the company. The cybercrime transactions using crypto coins dropped by more than half to $10 billion, but because overall cryptocurrency transaction volume increased, the share of cybercrime dropped even more precipitously to account for only 0.34% of all cryptocurrency transactions in 2020, down from more than 2% in 2019. Now, the use of a cryptocurrency money laundering scheme known as mixing has declined since a spike in the third quarter of 2019, according to Chainalysis data. And that is due to a number of things. One thing that it's not due to, though, is the fact that three strains of ransomware, Ryuk, Maze, and Doppelpaymer, accounted for more than half of all the known ransom payments. However, the company warned against drawing too many conclusions, as many strains of ransomware are used to enable ransomware as a service offerings. In other words, different cyber criminal groups may be using the same or a related collection of a single piece of malware.
Now, we've all heard the jokes. Linux admin says, make me a sandwich. Minion says, no. Linux admin says, sudo, make me a sandwich. Minion says, okay. But it's no joke when an ancient sudo security hole is actually uncovered. Now, for those unaware of the Unix command line ways, sudo is a prefix that grants regular users administrative powers for whatever command they wish to execute. Now, it's a handy tool for actually voiding the use of the root account directly, which in Linux's case is always a dangerous proposition. Now, in the past, many so-called Linux vulnerabilities turn out upon closer examination to be no big deal. But then there's the ones like sudo's CVE-2021-3156, aka Baron Samedi. With this one, if you're slow at keeping your computers up to date, you're in big trouble. Now, this sudo heap-based buffer overflow can be exploited by any local user. Worse still, any Joe or Jane user can actually leverage it to elevate privileges to root, even if they're not listed in the sudoer's file. Now, usually when you run a sudo command in a shell mode, you escape any special characters in the command's arguments with a backslash. Now, the sudoer's policy plugin then removes the escape characters from the arguments before evaluating the policy. Now, the same code will read beyond last character of the string and it ends up with an escaped backslash character. Now, usually that doesn't matter. However, things go south due to another bug. An attacker can run sudo edit with either the dash s or dash I options in the shell parsing the code. Now, why is that bad? Because it enables the shell mode and no command actually runs. Sudo does not escape the special characters. Finally, the code that actually decides whether to remove the escape characters doesn't check whether a command is actually being run. So what ends up happening is when the command line reaches sudoer's policy main program or set command, it actually concatenates the command line arguments and it causes a heap based buffer. Now, without any idea of how long the command is, it's actually vulnerable to actually heap-based buffer overflow using out-of-bounds characters in that argument's buffer. Now, the theory may sound super complex, you know, if you could be able to follow all that, but in practice, it's actually a trivial thing to exploit. Now, to start screwing around, all you need to do is actually enter the command sudo edit-s. Now, with any command line argument ending with a single backslash character. Now, take a moment and actually internalize all that information. Think about it. Just as you make sure you aren't thinking about this, make sure you're also thinking about updating yourself, because there's a ton of botnets targeting Linux systems these days because using simple brute force attacks. And so your machine could already be compromised. This is a very easy way to exploit. Now, if you haven't already, patch your system because all major distros have one.
Well, to switch over to good news, app variety and security innovation both surged in 2020. A new report out this week shows the measurable impact the pandemic had in not only accelerating the use of new and existing apps and services supporting remote work, but also bringing a bevy of next-gen security tools. Okta's Business at Work report is based on a deep dive analysis into the usage patterns across 9,400 organizations using more than 6,500 Okta access and authentication integrations with cloud, mobile, and web apps, along with IT infrastructure providers. The results show that 9 of the top 10 fastest growing apps in the report had never been on the list in previous reports. The list of apps provide a glimpse into the ways companies and their workers adjusted to new realities. It includes new collaboration tools such as whiteboarding app Miro, interface design and prototyping software Figma, and project management service Monday.com. With so many HR departments managing distributed workforces, people management platform at Lattice made it onto the list. Top of the heap? Well, that was an app that probably few technologists would have immediately guessed, but which makes total sense. Amazon Business, which surged by 346% as workers rushed to order office supplies and furniture for their new home offices. And then, of course, were the security enablers, which saw significant gains. 4 of the top 10 fastest growers were security tools: next-gen firewall Fortinet FortiGate, cloud-native endpoint and workload protection provider VMware Carbon Black, application monitoring service Sentry, and password manager 1Password. Organizations seem likely to be looking for better solutions in the long run. Okta noted that its adaptive authentication form factor was up even more during this time period for the survey, seeing a gain of 184% compared with the steady 28% rise it experienced the 6 months prior to the pandemic.
Botnets have been a frequent attack mechanism due to the ever-expanding infrastructure as a service model. Now, however, it's good news for a lot of people who have been the victim of the Emotet botnet. Now, police have seized thousands of computers running on the most dangerous hacking networks worldwide. Now, the Emotet network obtains access to victims' computers via malicious email attachments, then sells it to criminals who actually install more damaging malware. Now, police from the UK, the EU, US, and Canada work together to disrupt Emotet. Now, Europol called it one of the most significant botnets of the past decade and one of the main door openers for computer systems worldwide. Now, once the unauthorized access was established, They were then sold to the other top-level criminal groups to deploy further illicit activities such as data theft or extortion through ransomware. Now, Imatet was initially banking Trojan. It was designed to spy on victims' computers and steal login details. Now, victims would receive an apparently important Word document marked for their attention. When they opened it, it would ask them to enable macros, a seemingly innocent feature built in Microsoft Word that actually opened their computer to additional attacks. The most successful and prevalent malware of 2020 by a long shot. It had been sent phishing emails with more than 150,000 different subject lines and 100,000 file names for the attachments over the year. Now, even though we can call this a win for the good guys, it might be a time to start stop opening random email attachments and get yourself some advanced threat protection.
Well, in the news this week, ransomware disrupted operations at packaging giant WestRock. Operations at the $17 billion packaging firm WestRock were distributed this week by a ransomware attack that impacted both its IT and OT, or operational technology, networks. The attack has already caused and will likely continue to cause delays in some parts of the company's business, WestRock announced on Monday, without offering any details regarding the nature of the attack or the disruptions. A statement from the company noted that WestRock is working with security vendors on system recovery efforts and on minimizing the impact on customers. The company described the incident as likely leading to a loss of revenue and incremental costs that could affect its bottom line. The ransomware incident at the paper and packaging giant is another reminder of the highly vulnerable nature of OT environments at many organizations. And increasingly, there are signs that attackers may be beginning to go specifically after those OT assets. For example, last year, a FireEye analysis found that kill lists used by attackers to shut down key processes on systems and networks before deploying ransomware have increasingly begun including OT processes as well. Specifically, the security vendor found two unique kill lists containing OT processes being used by the operators of seven prolific ransomware families, including Maze, Doppelpaymer, LockerGoga, and MegaCortex.
You'll never find a more wretched hive of scun and villainy as you would on the dark web. Well, the U.S. and Bulgarian authorities this week took control of the dark website used by the NetWalker ransomware cybercrime group to publish data stolen from his victims. Now, in connection with the takedown, a Canadian national was charged in the U.S. state of Florida for extorting $27.6 million in cryptocurrency from ransomware payments. Now, separately, the Bulgarian National Investigation Service combating organized crime seized a dark web hidden resource used by NetWalker ransomware affiliates to provide payment instructions and communicate with victims. Now, these are the cybercrime groups responsible for identifying and attacking high-value victims using ransomware. Now, visitors to the website will now be greeted by a seizure banner notifying them that it's been taken over by law enforcement authorities. Now, authorities could trace more than $46 million worth of funds in NetWalker ransom since it first came into the scene in August 2019. Now, it picked up steam in mid-2020, growing the average ransom to $65,000 last year, up from $18,800 in 2019. Now, in the recent months, NetWalker emerged as a popular choice of ransomware streams beside Ryuk, Maze, or Doppelpaymer, with numerous companies, hospitals, schools, and universities targeted by the cyber criminals to extort the victims. Now, before the takedown, the NetWalker administrator, who goes by the moniker Bugatti on the Darknet forums, is said to have posted an advertisement in May 2020. Now, they were looking for additional Russian-speaking affiliates as part of a transition to a ransom as a service model, using the partners to actually compromise targets and steal data before encrypting the files. Now, the NetWalker operators have also been part of a growing ransomware trend called double extortion. The attackers hold the stolen data hostage and then actually threaten to publish the information should target actually refuse to pay the ransom. And remember my mention of the takedown targeting the Imatet crime as a service network? Well, it's been quite the week in the fight against cybercrime. Unfortunately, it may just be a matter of time before another ransomware group is back on the prowl, because, you know, there's always a bigger fish. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to the bites, we have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Forward Networks. Now, your network is mission critical, right? It's really important to your business. While Forward Networks will help you reduce network outages, improve your troubleshooting, and eliminate those errors. Now, they reduce business risk by revolutionizing the way large networks are actually managed. Now, four Stanford PhD graduates developed Forward Network 7 years ago, and they actually developed empathy for the network operators like you and sought to actually apply modern software development principles to the network. Now, this is amazing. Listen to this. Their advanced software delivers a digital twin of the network. It's actually an entirely accurate mathematical model in software and serves as a single source of truth for the web. Now, users can verify that the network is configured correctly, it complies with policies, and that it behaves exactly as you intended. Now, they can even accurately predict the impact of proposed changes across every possible traffic path so network operators can roll out changes with confidence. Now, this ensures that your network stays healthy and agile all the time. Super important. Now, here's some of what Forward Networks actually does. First, they have their dashboard actually provides key network insights with visualizations that are easily consumable and exportable, and they automatically create always accurate network diagrams with full details about the topology of the environment. Very cool. Plus, you can search network behavior configuration and state network-wide with an intuitive, powerful tools as well. You can perform end-to-end path analysis across your network from both on-prem and cloud infrastructure, and you can proactively identify potential connectivity and security policy violations as well. Now, anytime you can verify that your network is configured and behaving exactly as intended across on-prem, cloud, and virtual overlay networks, plus you can set, check, and customize policies for your entire network. Now, they also have a great feature that all pros should have, behavior diffs. Now, it allows that side-by-side comparison in one quick view of a configuration file changes for any device, now between any endpoint and any point in time. Now, if you're wondering how effective Forward Networks is, listen to this. Get 50% faster resolution of network trouble tickets, 90% faster fixes related to audit processes, and 33% reduction in aborted network updates due to identified errors. Now, imagine searching your network for what's causing the problems. Forward Networks allows you to do that. Now, PayPal has been having issues with their network and it considered building a better system. Instead, they turned to Forward Networks and they actually found that all they needed was the software that could help them find the trouble spots, saving them time and money. Now, Forward Networks collaborates with a range of infrastructure and application partners from the world's leading IT companies to innovators. Now, they've worked with Bank of America, Verizon, Goldman Sachs, and several large government agencies as well. Now, Forward Networks announced their Series C funding round last October, led by Goldman Sachs. Also participating were Andreessen Horowitz and Threshold, formerly DFJ. In total, their investments have committed $65 million. Get network automation and verification for your intent-based network with Forward Networks. Your business depends on it. Get a demo at forwardnetworks.com/twit. That's forwardnetworks.com/twit. And check out their new podcast, Seeking Truth in Networking. You can download it anywhere you get your podcasts. And we thank Forward Networks for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's time for the bites. We have a couple good ones here today. Now, it's hard to forget 2020, right? Big year. It was the year of a pandemic and the year that the evil telecoms decided to remove their data caps for a short period of time, right? Well, that was unfortunately short-lived. Comcast has started to reactivate those data caps just as they were. Well, still sheltering in place. People were still sheltering in place. And a good percentage of states are still, you know, in the pandemic and in sheltering in place, rules are still in effect. Well, that's okay because the state of Massachusetts is responding to Comcast. State lawmakers have proposed a ban on data caps and new fees and price increases on home internet services for the pandemic duration. Say what? That's right. Thank you, Massachusetts, for starting the trend. Now, the legislation was filed on Tuesday this week by Democratic State Representative Andy Vargas and Dave Rogers. Now, Vargas has actually called the bill a response to Comcast internet data cap plans, while Rogers said the goal is to push back at Comcast and any other service providers who try to raise prices or fees during a pandemic. Now, Verizon, Fios, and RCN also provide internet service to the Massachusetts area, but do not impose data caps, which is nice. Now, they also led a group of 71 Massachusetts lawmakers who urged Comcast to halt enforcement of its 1.2 terabyte monthly data cap as well. Now, they argued that the cap hurts low-income people and is unnecessary because Comcast's robust network can handle it. Now, while Comcast already enforced that data cap in 27 states for several years, the cable company brought the cap to the rest of its territories and an additional 12 states, including Massachusetts, and the District of Columbia this month. Now, Comcast is easing in enforcement. So the first coverage charges, the first overage card charges for newly capped customers will actually be assessed for data usage in August, an August billing cycle. That actually changed from April. Now, the bill proposes emergency law necessary for immediate preservation of public convenience. Now, it would remain in effect for the duration of the COVID-19 state of emergency that the governor, Charlie Baker, declared in March 2020, and for at least 60 days after the state of emergency is declared to be ended. Now, moreover, ISPs would not be allowed to, quote, increase the costs of internet plans or, quote, levy any new fees or charges related to broadband service or shut off broadband internet access service or services for subscribers that are unable to pay due to overdue bills due to financial hardships caused by the COVID-19 emergency. Now, the proposal is to ban internet shutoffs is similar to a provision in the Keep Americans Connected pledge announced in March 2020 by then Federal Communications Commission's Chairman Ajit Pai. Now, Curtis, I want to bring you in here because, you know, this sounds like Massachusetts is doing the right thing. What do you think?
Well, I'm in favor of getting rid of these limits. I mean, I'm a big fan of unlimited data, but I do have some sort of philosophical questions. And among them is, if capping people's data is a bad thing during a pandemic, why does it suddenly become better when people aren't sick? What is it about so many people being sick that makes us say, you know, the normal scummy behavior that you have, we need to let you to be about 12% less scummy to make everything better? I think this is the sort of thing that should be the way the companies operate anyway. My real question, to be honest, is whether a law is the best way to do this. Now, I say this as someone who lives in a state, Florida, where they have similar laws regarding prices of goods and services following a hurricane. Price gouging is specifically disallowed by law, which means that if you've got, you know, once a hurricane warning has gone up and the states of emergency that accompany that, you can't suddenly start charging $100 for a sheet of plywood. You can't suddenly start charging $50 for a crate of bottled water. Your prices have to be pretty much in line with what they were the day before the state of emergency. And there are legal consequences if they're not. This is an interesting thing about our sort of capitalist system where rules are bad until they're good. And I think that this is only one of this sort of law that we're going to see during and in the immediate aftermath of the COVID pandemic.
I agree. I think that, you know, the interesting thing here is, most people are working remote. So they needed to have, you know, a lot of people that I even work with are still using the consumer grade network connectivity because they can obviously get the faster speed packages for less than a business internet. And I have business internet, which means that, you know, I have priority on the nodes and I have a little bit more reliability. They also have an SLA on servicing and so on and so forth. But I pay a premium price, and that means that also removes the cap. But a lot of people around here, they still just use the consumer stuff. And we had a power outage a couple weeks back, and a lot of people just couldn't do work, even on their laptops, because they didn't have any power to run. And plus, the consumer side went down. Now I could actually do work a little bit because actually my modem had a backup and it also had cellular and all this stuff. And so like I was able to do all these things, again, paying a premium. But a lot of people can't afford to do that. And I think that's what's interesting here is consumers have bought into the faster speeds and the better packages, and they're using a ton more data now because they're sitting at home most of the time. But they are now used to doing that. So now these companies are saying, no, you know, even though you're used to all doing all that, you have to go back to the, you know, even though you might still be at home, we're going to put the caps back on and we're going to start charging you. Like, I'm actually glad that Massachusetts has started this ball rolling, because I want the rest of the states to do it too. I want them to push back and say, like you said, you're being scummy here. Like, you're being horrible, and you're poking at people who are, you know, who are still in a current state, and you shouldn't be doing that. You shouldn't be taking advantage of consumers like that. And you're stuck between a rock and a hard place. So I hope that this gets better. Now, one thing I want to throw back to you, Curtis, then we can move on to the next bite. The new FCC chairwoman, she's just started. She's got a lot of work to do, but I'm wondering why she's kind of silent here. Like, you know, obviously she's got a lot of things to do here. Do you think, Curtis, that the FCC should actually get involved here so they can actually kickstart the economy a bit more after the stimulus?
I think that we're likely to see more action from the FCC later. Why is she being quiet? I think a lot of it has to do with what the current administration's priorities are for the first few weeks of their administration. They've been awfully busy in a bunch of areas. But I do think that as attention swings to the pandemic recovery efforts and the stimulus package that will certainly be hitting Congress before too long, that we'll start to see responses from other parts of government as well, including the FCC. And if history is any indication, I think the current chairman does have a higher likelihood of being active in protecting consumers and less active in protecting the carriers. She's likely to feel that the carriers can take care of themselves and that it's right. The individual consumers who need protection. And, you know, you were talking about data caps. I do want to throw out one additional consideration. We've been talking about business, and that's why, you know, we are this week in enterprise technology. But there are still an awful lot of kids doing school from home over video channels, and that soaks up a ton of capacity as well. I mean, think about your situation. If all of your children were of school age and all doing remote learning, you would your lines would glow a bright cherry red from all the data flowing through them during school hours. And there are a fair amount of the households in the country who have a situation like that. I mean, I notice in my neighborhood where we have a mix of kids who have gone back to in-school learning and remote, there are certain hours of the day when my response on the internet drops because I can tell when the big peak hours are for classroom interaction, because we start seeing some lag. So a lot of things. And the one big piece that I do hope comes after this, we've talked in the past about the digital divide between the people who can afford true high-speed internet and those who can't. I'm hoping that one of the consequences and one of the good outcomes from all of the bad that's going on right now is that the digital divide narrows considerably when we get through all of this.
I agree. Well, that does it for that bite. We do have another great one. Now, it's now more than ever that we ensure our data is private, because, you know, especially with the pandemic going on and the pandemic response data. Curtis, you want to take this one?
Sure. Well, to show how important data privacy is, yesterday, January 28th, was Data Privacy Day 2021. And it is all focused on helping people understand what their rights are regarding privacy and what their responsibilities are to ensure that privacy. You know, there is globally a huge variation in what privacy means and how privacy is enforced online. You have nations and nation states where it is a high priority, places like Europe, with its very prominent and commonly talked about GDPR regulations. Then you have places like the United States, where your data, your personal data, is viewed as a fungible thing that you can sell by. And the thing is, you don't have to really be made aware of when you are swapping that privacy for something. And let's be really honest, the penalties against individuals and companies that abuse that privacy are very small. So we have looked at what privacy means, and one of the key concepts that's been in the business world but is becoming something that more consumers are becoming aware of is the notion of zero trust. Now, this has been around for a decade or so in the security world, and basically it means that at every transaction and at every step in the transaction, you have to explicitly grant permission for data to flow. You don't say, I granted permission to use one example, Facebook, and therefore I'm cool with whatever they do with my data and whatever any of their clients or customers do with my data. Zero trust means that you have to say yes or no every time. So it's interesting to watch because many people confuse privacy and security. They're related, but very different. And that difference is critical. Lou, I want to ask you, when you are talking to people about privacy, do you find that they frequently come to you with concepts from security that have little to do with privacy? Or do you think that most people have a pretty good idea of what the terms mean?
I think you're 100% correct. I think they always get confused. It doesn't matter if I'm talking with small or medium-sized businesses or even enterprises. Sometimes they get it wrong. And it's usually around storage. Like, where is my data being stored? They get confused on how it's being locked and keyed away, how it's being secured versus who's able to see it, who's able to interact with it, is it being distributed amongst more than one source that I don't know about. And I think that's one of the big things that organizations need to pay attention to, obviously, especially when they're storing things in the cloud, for sure, is that they're making sure that the data is not only secured in a way with the quote unquote zero trust model, where you know it's isolated away and only you have access to it, or only the people that need to have access to it have access to it. But in the same sense, it's put in a place where other services can't interact with it, or it can't be sent somewhere, or if it's stored in a public place and they do analytics on it, are they removing the PII, or with GDPR, do I know it's there and can it be removed? And so these are very complex things, and sometimes it requires privacy and consultants to come in and say, you have a complex setup and you deal with different clientele for different parts of the market. Here's how you need to make sure things are flowing and being stored and so on. And so it becomes in its own market. It basically becomes its own market. And I think that's a challenging thing for any organization. But you're right. Like, I think they do sometimes get that wrong and don't really understand the differences between those two, and that you're going to need, consulting sometimes, as well as, higher level systems to support them both.
Very true. And one of the things that we have to remember from the enterprise perspective and from the business perspective is that many times your responsibilities when it comes to privacy deal not with the size of your business, but with the reach of your customer base. It's very easy in these times for a very small business to have an entirely international client base. And that means in many cases that customer's data is subject to the regulations and laws of the place where they live, not the place where you do business. So it can be critical to keep up with privacy. And what I think we're going to see more and more is a situation where the default is to ask for explicit permission, to limit the permissions you seek, and then where you limit the data you store in response to those limited permissions. The easiest thing in the world is just not to store data that you don't want to pay to protect. And that's a good lesson on this day after Data Privacy Day 2021. 2021.
Thank you, Curtis. Well, folks, that does it for the Bites. But next up, we have a guest, actually two guests, to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Ride. But before we get to all that, we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Nareva. Now, as we think about heading back to the office, we know that we will meet with a lot of change. Now, distancing can have big implications for meeting rooms audio because, you know, requires sometimes room configuration changes. And the most crucial factor here is the need for good mic coverage when people are distancing in a meeting space. The most conventional audio systems do not offer the flexibility you need to actually easily accommodate those changes. Now, beamforming systems will need to be adjusted often by expensive technicians that actually have to come in and change their configuration. Now, tabletop systems may actually require additional mics, and you may have to sanitize the mics before and between meetings. Now, both may require meeting participants to actually change their behaviors as well, like sitting in predetermined spots, which may be in a direction they need to face. Now, what if there was a better way to get clear, reliable audio and let the team actually act normal and natural and still feel safe? Nareva Audio is designed for distancing. One analyst called Nareva Audio the first socially distanced mic system. Now, Nareva uses completely original approach to audio conferencing called microphone mist technology. Now, it actually fills the room with thousands of virtual microphones, and you'll get true full room coverage so people can actually be heard from anywhere in the room, no matter where they sit or they face or how they're distanced. And you don't need to bring in technicians with Nareva Audio because it'll just work. You can install each microphone and speaker bar yourself on the wall, and Nareva Audio automatically adapts to any room configuration. And microphone mist technology is so advanced, they actually have 4 patents. Now, I can tell you, I'm in meeting rooms all the time, and people are sitting in the corner. They're sitting below the camera. They're sitting over here. They're sitting over there just to get, you know, step away from either the person who's coughing or, you know, maybe just to be kind of like in their own little spot. And then when they try to talk, again, it's really tough to understand. They have to move forward. We can't hear you. It disrupts the meeting. This is going to fix all that. Now, Nareva Audio products have won numerous awards, including the top new technology award of ISE 2020 for the Nareva HDL 200 system. Now, no matter the size of your room, they have a full line of systems for small, medium, and large spaces. Now, HubSpot is a happy customer. Jimmy Ann, the principal collaboration engineer, says, "We were so impressed with the sound quality, ease of install, and ease of use of the HDL 300. It was a no-brainer for us to adopt it." To learn more about how Nareva Audio is the simple and cost-effective way to let your teams distance in meetings and still act and converse naturally, visit nareva.com/twit. That's NUREVA.com/twit. And we thank Nareva for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show where we actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Ride. And today we have Brian Gorentz. He's a senior director of vulnerability research at Trend Micro, and Dustin Childs, communication manager at Trend Micro. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thanks for having us. Happy to be here.
Absolutely. Well, obviously, we have a lot to talk about here. But first, if you can give maybe the audience a short taste of who you guys are and maybe your journey through tech and actually what brought you to Trend Micro. Start with you, Brian.
Yeah, sure. My name is Brian Gorentz, Senior Director of Vulnerability Research here at Trend Micro. Getting into tech, I mean, I basically was a software developer. I used to work at a defense contractor for about a decade, worked on some secure systems and really got into the secure software development lifecycle, and really got into the looking for bugs, trying to find weaknesses in software. And so, once the project was over at the defense contractor, I decided to move on into the InfoSec world and came and joined the Tipping Point IPS group, and where we were doing signature authoring for detecting exploits on the wire. I did a lot of research and ended up running a program called the Zero Day Initiative, which is the world's largest vendor agnostic bug bounty program, and have been here over at Trend Micro trying to bring out some of the best research in the world and fix bugs in other people's software and in our software.
Fantastic, fantastic. Welcome. Dustin.
Yeah, so my journey starts back in the late 90s in the Air Force. I was enlisted and assigned to the Air Force Computer Emergency Response Team, or the AFCERT. So in the late 90s, I was taught how to catch hackers, and that was a lot of fun. We did some interesting things back then. Solar Sunrise Moonlight Maze, if you want to Google that for my greatest hits. Then became a defense contractor for a while and then ended up at Microsoft working in the MSRC, the Security Response Center, doing the Patch Tuesday. So all of the patches that were coming out every month or Windows were some of mine. MS-08067, if you've ever dealt with Configure, that was my case. So sorry, I guess, about that. And then when I was at Microsoft, we would get cases reported in from the Zero Day Initiative, and I would have to run those. And at some point, I thought it would be a lot easier over there reporting the cases than to be at Microsoft receiving the cases. So I jumped over to Trend Micro to work with the Zero Day Initiative and help tell their story.
Fantastic. Well, welcome, guys. Yeah, I'm glad we brought Curtis because I think we have a good discussion that's going to happen here, because obviously endpoint security is a huge topic. It's changed significantly, I think, even over the last year, obviously, since the perimeter, network perimeter has really changed. Can you maybe take us through, one of you guys, take us through what's going on, what you're seeing, what the trends are showing, especially with how people are working remotely?
Yeah, I think if you look at, so one of the programs that we run is the Zero Day Initiative program. And what that program does is it actually reaches out and to researchers around the world and encourages them to disclose vulnerabilities through us. And so with this program, we're actually able to get a really good understanding of the types of bugs and the attack surface that exists in software. You know, and what we saw this last year is, well, a lot more people looking for bugs because they had more free time. And so we had an increase in the number of vulnerabilities that people were sending to us, but also the types of vulnerabilities were changing too. Like they're starting to look in some of the software that's being used for remote work. They were looking for vulnerabilities in the cloud components that are out there. And so it's been kind of an interesting shift, from client side server side stuff into what's affecting the actual end user and the people who are working remotely.
Yeah, another thing that we saw that was different for this past year is since your network perimeter is now effectively your home wireless router, we saw a lot more research into wireless routers, especially on the low end, that people could get from Amazon, Walmart, Target, wherever. There's a lot of research going into those for now that people are like working from home. So I'm not sitting behind a big enterprise level firewall. I've got my little TP-Link, or I've got my Linksys, and that's okay. It. So that was an interesting shift that we saw this past year as well.
So I want to ask one question around that, because I obviously know how my company is handling that. I'm not gonna give the secrets out about that. But I do know that I'm sitting at home. I do have my TP-Link back there, and it might be a little higher than consumer grade, but again, it's still probably vulnerable to all the things that you're talking about here. What are you seeing organizations do to help with that? Like, how obviously they're gonna have people sitting at home and they're gonna be accessing systems and data that they probably don't want people to access other than them. What can help here? What are you guys seeing, and what are organizations doing?
Dustin, you wanna take that one?
Sure, so we are seeing an increase in the amount of security spending. So I think the first thing that companies are doing is just throwing money at the problem and hoping something sticks. I'm not sure that the enterprise spending is very thoughtful, but I know, especially within Trend Micro, we have a wide range of products that are designed to help at different places throughout a network, endpoints or otherwise. And I know we've seen a lot of increase in spending in those products and trying to help customers and enterprises understand what the problem is. I think that's the biggest thing we see right now is we understand that there's a problem, and enterprises know that, okay, well, this is a new threat model I haven't, thought of before, but I don't know how to handle it. So I think what they're doing right now is they're just reacting. Hopefully we'll see some more fine tuning as we go. I think, VPNs are obviously a big thing. Two-factor authentication, I think, has rolled out at a much greater level now than it has in the previous years. And I think people are really starting to take it seriously that it's like, hey, my workforce is remote. It's not just one or two people on this team. It's now everyone. So we've got to shift all of our defenses to handling that sort of a problem.
Well, now I have a question regarding the enterprise side of that, because in a lot of cases, when you talk about throwing money at a problem, the technology that's being put in place is a species of what an individual consumer might buy for their endpoint. Are you seeing big differences in the way companies try to manage all of the detection and response out on those remote endpoints? some of the three-letter acronyms that I've been rolling around in for the past couple of months include Endpoint Detection Response, EDR, and MDR, Managed Detection and Response, and now, of course, XDR. I figure before it's over, we'll go just run through the whole alphabet for some company
we will.
Or another.
We'll get there sooner or later.
But, you know, from where you sit, are companies actually rolling these endpoints into a managed logical whole perimeter defense?
Well, from what we're seeing right now is they are, but not to their benefit. If anything, right now, they're drowning in alerts. And so they are trying to get some sort of some more letters out there, SIEM, you know, a SIM out there, an enterprise, you know, whether it's Splunk or whether it's ArcSight or something to try and consolidate all of these alerts. And now all that money they've spent, well, those things are producing alerts. And now they've got to try and organize them somehow that makes sense, and they're overwhelmed with it. So they got the new puppy for Christmas, but now they have to train the puppy. And that's, if you've ever had a puppy, that's quite a challenge. And if you've ever installed a new SIM, then all of a sudden everything's alerting. The world is on fire. And, you know, your CEO's bringing down on your neck and like, what are we doing about all these alerts? And so it takes some time to kind of figure it out. And you know what? I don't even have Apache servers. Why am I alerting on Apache server signatures? You know what? That sort of thing. So hopefully they'll fine tune that a little bit. But right now it's an abundance of alerts that we're seeing.
It's interesting to me the language that you used, because one, I have talked to half a dozen companies in the past few weeks that were doing their 2020 report wrap-ups. You know, they're here's what happened, here's what we think is going to happen. And one of the things that's consistent is, as you say, companies are throwing more money at security, whether you're talking about the technology or the engineering or the integration across the board. They're spending more, but their satisfaction with the results of that spending, that needle's not moving, or if it is, it may be going down slightly. Do you think that we could be due for some sort of economic correction where, you know, next year all of a sudden they say, hey, we spent all this extra money and I don't feel warm and fuzzy about what happened, so let's cut back on our security spend, which seems like a bad result. But, you know, is that one of the things that you are concerned that might be a company corporate response in the future?
Well, I think as you see some of these companies, they're starting to source out some of the management of the detection and response to give them, you know, more effective use of the services that they actually are purchasing from companies like ours. And I think that's, you know, a good thing, you know, getting the, you know, we do have a talent gap in this industry. And so it does help to actually go out there and try to get some managed detection response and actually be able to action on some of that intelligence that's coming in and some of the hits that are coming in and allowing us to actually better understand what's actually happening in their actual infrastructure and in their network.
And kind of piggyback on what you said as well, like 2020 for us was our busiest year for buying bugs. We bought more bugs in 2020 than we ever had. And I think that's part of the problem too is, yes, they're spending more money. Yes, enterprises are investing more in security, but everyone else on the offensive side, on the security research side, they're investing more as well. And I think right now they're outpacing the defenders. There's so many security researchers around the world. I mean, we've worked with over 5,000 independent security researchers in the 15-year lifespan of the Zero Day Initiative. And it keeps growing and growing and growing. And it's asymmetric. So the defenders are going to have some bad times if they try to keep up one for one. So they'll, like Brian said, they'll have to outsource some of their defense to maintain that level of satisfaction, or just understand that sometimes they're going to have some bad months.
You know, I want to ask what may be a trivial question based on this whole thing of trying to keep up with vulnerabilities and bugs. This week saw the reported death and rebirth of BugTrack. And for our listeners who don't know, BugTrack is a mailing list that predates the CVE system for keeping track of vulnerabilities and bugs. So I'll ask each of you guys, first of all, would you mourn the passing of BugTrack, and do you think that it has outlived its usefulness? I mean, is the CVE system now sufficiently robust to make BugTrack one of these charming relics of an earlier age?
Yeah, I look at BugTrack, and you know, when they made the announcement that it was going to go away, I was a little bit sad because I've been watching that for a very, very long time. But I think the one challenge we have now is the amount of vulnerability research and the amount of people discovering bugs has really grown significantly over the last 15 years, especially through the ZDI program. And so is a mailing list the best way to keep track of all of the vulnerabilities in the world? Probably not. I mean, I think we look at CVE, you know, making good efforts at trying to track vulnerabilities, but there's even weaknesses in the CVE system itself, the way that they merge vulnerabilities into a single CVE, and it makes tracking of like individual CVEs challenging. It's just when you look at the actual problem of, you know, managing, you know, 20,000 plus vulnerabilities per year, it's not easy. And I think right now, probably the best system we do have is the CVE system for tracking bugs.
Yeah, I as an old school guy too, starting in the mid 90s, I checked BugTrack all the time as well. And it was kind of funny when they made the announcement. It's like, oh yeah, I kind of forgot BugTrack was a thing, and it was a big deal at the time too. So I do kind of mourn its passing. I certainly do think it's outlived its usefulness, just as Brian said, because of the scale. CVE, when it came in, because I predate CVE as well, it certainly made things so much easier for tracking bugs, because Symantec would call a bug one thing, and then McAfee would call it something else, and maybe Microsoft called it something else. But now we can all say, well, this is CVE 2020-14005 or whatever it is, and we can at least agree on that. CVE certainly has its problems, especially like Brian said, when you get multiple things tagged to one CVE, which is kind of against the rules, but not everyone follows that. It's certainly a good framework, and I certainly don't want to be the person to come up with a replacement for it to try and improve on it.
So one thing we've seen, you know, a trend in obviously last year alone is ransomware. And I think obviously a lot of organizations are like, well, we're beefing up our perimeter, we're adding more layers. And so that helps, you know, with that. And of course, the obligatory answer of like combating ransomware is just make sure organizations have backups. You know, what are you guys seeing? You work with a lot of organizations. What are you seeing organizations do rather than just throw money at it? Are they doing something more unique than that? Or are they just saying, hey, we'll buy insurance, we'll beef up the security, we'll put some backups in?
Yeah, the insurance is definitely an angle that we've seen more as it's come out. But now the insurers are like, oh, no, we actually have to pay out for this. So we're seeing some shift in that as well. For us, one thing that we see is, the ZDI, we purchase bugs and we take those bugs and make signatures for them for our tipping point appliance and put them out ahead of the actual vendor patch. Now, that gives you 0-day protection. But as you guys know, 0-day exploits are pretty rare. But what most people don't think of is almost all of this ransomware, I can count on one hand the number of ransomware families that have relied on a 0-day. Everything else relies on N-day exploits, meaning that there's been a patch out available for N number of days. And besides backups, the best thing you can do to prevent ransomware is keep your systems updated and keep them fully patched, right? But we've had some differences. You know, we've had some problems over the years. People are a little afraid of security patches because patches break things, or they introduce new vulnerabilities, or this happens, or this happens. So the signatures that we're putting out for 0-day are still there for N-day, and they're relying on that to test and deploy patches rather than having to just scramble and hope everything works and hope it doesn't break the Exchange server this month. With the security patches come out, and not to just pick on Microsoft, it's happened with Apple, it's happened with Google, it's happened with every major vendor, Cisco, IBM, where they've put out patches and they've just broken stuff, or they haven't worked as advertised. So we see that vulnerability management, that patch management, as a key to a lot of defenders' response when it comes to many things, but specifically ransomware.
Now, Brian, I'm going to throw this to you because I know that you work with a lot of organizations here. Are they, obviously, they're, you know, we're talking a little bit about like how they handle things, but are they changing the physical way that they're doing things? Are they adding, like I said, more layers? Are they adding more systems, like to make sure that they, you know, that social engineering techniques can't get access to the network, or like at that advanced threat protection, that kind of thing, in order to combat, you know, more proactively for ransomware? Are they just reacting?
Yeah, I think a lot of them are taking, you know, more of a defense in depth type of approach to trying to stop the ransomware threat, you know, looking at endpoint sensors, trying to tie those into detection and response systems so that they can actually, you know, if they're compromised, or we can do some maybe, you know, looking at the logs of the systems that are coming in to see if we can see any insights into some early activity that may happen before the ransomware threat actually is launched. You know, I think, that's one approach that we're kind of looking at here at Trend Micro, is trying to figure out, you know, what we can do to alert on, you know, some of the activity that happens before ransomware is launched, and making sure that we can protect in that way. So, you know, we're seeing companies and people using information security technology trying to leverage, you know, multiple sources to actually help us defend against the ransomware threat.
Makes sense. And one thing I wanted to shift really quick too is obviously privacy. We brought up in the beginning of the show the fact that organizations sometimes don't know the difference between security versus privacy. And one of the things that, of course, your website even lists is that, you know, GDPR is a big thing, and compliance is one of those key features that organizations need to focus on. What are you seeing organizations doing, and maybe even what is Trend Micro helping with there?
Yeah, GDPR, I mean, a lot of us, you know, we're learning how the system works as well. But you have to, like, even in our program that we're running, we're making sure that, you know, the we're in compliance with GDPR and trying to help guide enterprises as we learn the process of actually applying GDPR restrictions and reporting and things like that. So I think, you know, a lot of it is, you know, the industry is learning how to implement some of that stuff. I think the focus on privacy is extremely important. You know, every user, we're even seeing companies now use privacy as like a marketing gimmick, like with Apple trying to, you know, ensure that people know that they are, you know, focusing on privacy on the iPhone. So I think, you know, not only is it good to implement those standards that are being implemented in GDPR, but you can actually use it for a benefit for your customers and try to acknowledge the fact that you are going through those steps to help secure and make their data more private.
Makes sense. So we are running a little low on time, but I didn't want you guys to maybe go through. I know that Trend Micro has been doing a lot here in this space, and you talked a little bit about the programs. Can you maybe talk a little bit about some of the solutions that you guys were providing as well?
Well, sure. So the most obvious one that we deal with is the tipping point intrusion prevention system. And that's like at line speed, IDS, IPS. And it goes fast, and that's its big selling point. So it can handle gigabits per second of traffic flowing through it, either in a passive mode or actively responding. And what we do with our program is we buy bugs, we work with the independent security researchers, and then develop filters for that product and send it out to the field. So customers have, on average, about 95 days of pre-release filters before the vendor, Microsoft, Apple, Cisco, IBM, whomever, really releases a security patch. And we've taken that IPS technology that was a big appliance that sits in a rack, and we now have a cloud instance of that as well. So we can even stand it up in line on a cloud instance without disrupting traffic. So that's really where our clients are headed. Everyone's migrating to the cloud, and they want that cloud security, and we're able to provide that. Obviously, we've got XDR, and we've got a bunch of other offerings. We primarily deal with the IPS side in our program. So that's where our kind of focus is. But we're expanding that as well. So zero-day protections only go out to the tipping point, but the end-day protections then get filtered out to everyone else, the endpoint securities and the other devices we have throughout our gallery of different items. So that knowledge, that threat intelligence that we're gaining filters out through all of the other products as well eventually, just whether it comes out before when it's zero day or end day.
Fantastic. Well, guys, like I said, all good things have to come to an end. We're running a little low on time. I did want to give you a chance maybe to tell folks at home where they can learn more about Trend Micro, where they can go maybe get started and learn more about some of the programs you got.
Sure. Best place to go is zerodayinitiative.com. That's our website. And we've got a blog out there with a bunch of stuff, too. Check out Pwn to Own, especially. That is our annual hacking contest. We just launched that this week for 2021. We've got a Tesla Model 3 that's going to be available. Again, if you can hack that, you pwn it, you own it. And this year, we've also got an enterprise communications category with Zoom and Microsoft Teams as targets. If you can hack one of those, it's $200,000. So that's a pretty good incentive to go. We've got Exchange out there this year, too. I think it's at $250,000. So hopefully we'll see a lot of really interesting research coming out of that that's coming up in April. So definitely stay tuned for that.
Fantastic. Brian, Dustin, thank you so much for being here, guys.
Thanks for the time.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having us.
Take care. Well, folks, you've done it again. You've sat through another hour of the Best Dang Enterprise podcast in the universe. So tune your podcatcher to Twyatt. I do want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. This is a team effort, and we really have the best team in the market, especially my co-host, starting with our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, what's going on for you in the coming week, and where can people find you and all your work?
Well, I'm going to be doing lots of research around little things like security dashboards. I have a piece coming up on that late in February. Also going to be working on something that will show up in dark reading, where I'm looking at people spending money on security integration and security architecture and just how happy or not they are with the results. That'll be coming out sometime this coming week on Dark Reading. Look for me now over under the Omdia tab on darkreading.com. And as always, I'll be referring to that on my Twitter feed. That's at KG4GWA.
Thank you, Curtis. Well, we also have to thank you as well. You are the person who drops in each and every week to watch and listen to our show to get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen and catch up on your IT and enterprise news. So go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twyatt. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, the show notes, the co-host information, and the guest information, especially the links of the stories we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those helpful, those nice, really nice videos there, you'll get those helpful subscribe and download links. Support the show by getting your audio version, your video version of your choice, and listen on any one of your devices and or even use any one of your podcast applications, because we're on all of them. So definitely check it out and subscribe. Now, it's really the best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news. And, you know, after you subscribe, you might as well impress your friends, your family members, your coworkers with the gift of Twyatt, because we talk about a lot of fun tech topics here on the show, and I think they'll find it fun and informative as well. So definitely subscribe and share it with them. Now, if you've already subscribed and you're available 1:30 p.m. Pacific on Fridays, we do the show live here at live.twit.tv. And you can come see behind the scenes, how the pizza's made, all the banter that we do. So definitely check it out if you're available, especially at 1:30 p.m. Fridays. And of course, you know, if you're going to be on watch the show live, you might as well jump into our chat room. I have the chat room right here in front of me. We have some great questions in there. We get some great content from them. And so if you're going to watch it live, you might as well jump into the chat room. And that's at irc.twit.tv. You can use the web to use that as well. You don't need an IRC chat client for it. And if you can't watch it live, you can't be part of the chat room live, and you want to be part of the conversation after you subscribed and watched the videos, well, come join the 24/7 discussion. We also have a really great website, twit.community. All the hosts are there. The Twit community is there. All the we have some great conversations about technology and all the topics of all the shows that we do. So definitely should check it out over there at twit.community. It's a 24/7 community discussion. Our annual survey is going super strong right now. We don't want you to miss your feedback here, your feedback opportunities. So go to twit.tv/survey21. That's twit.tv/survey21. Take it right now before it closes on February 8th. Now, the survey helps us really understand you, our audience, so you can make your listening experience even better. So go check it out. It'll only take a few minutes, and all you need to do is go to twit.tv/survey21 to take it. Now, remember, you can always follow me, twitter.com/LouMM. There I post all my latest and greatest enterprise tidbits. I have some great conversations with you as well. Plus, you can see what I do during my normal work week at Microsoft. And of course, you can always check out the stuff at developers.microsoft.com/office. There's the latest and greatest ways to customize your office experience for your organization. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support This Week at Enterprise Tech each and every week, and we really couldn't do the show without their support. So thank you for all their support. Also, I want to thank all the engineers and the staff at Twit. And of course, I also want to thank Mr. Brian Chibert. He is packing up and he's moving out of the great state of Hawaii. So he's very busy right now, but he's also not only our co-host on some episodes, but he's also our Tyler's producer as well. He gets all the show bookings and he does all the notes for the show and the bookings and the plannings. And we really just couldn't do the show without him. He's lurking in behind the scenes here, and we want to let him know. Thank you, Chibert, for all your support. And of course, before we sign out, we have to thank our editor, Mr. Victor. Thank you for making us look good each and every week. And of course, Mr. Amp Pruitt. He is the man behind the curtain. He's the guy with the controls. He's making us sound great, look great. Amp, thanks for everything. What's going on for you in the coming week at Twit?
Well, this week I spent some time trying to tell folks how much I hate taking selfies on my show, Hands-On Photography. But I got something even better than that. So make sure you subscribe, twit.tv/hop.
Absolutely, absolutely. Thank you, Ant. Well, until next time, I'm Lewis from Resco, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
If you like Android with a heavy dose of fun and entertainment, then you're going to love All About Android. It's me, Jason Howell, along with my co-hosts Ron Richards and Florence Ion. Every Tuesday, we discuss the news items that matter most, the hardware and devices that are running Android, and the apps that run on top of them. Plus, we answer your email each and every week. That's All About Android on twit.tv.